At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
We got a look in the economic mirror today. Not all that great. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 26th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Not for the first time on this program, and now that I think about it, actually, not for the first time this week, we begin with a macroeconomic, wait, what? A new report from the Census Bureau today, the American Community Survey, it's called, ACS in the vernacular, shows that the gap between rich and poor in this country is the biggest it's been since the Census Bureau started keeping track of it more than 50 years ago. The wait, what part comes when I remind you that the American economy is in the longest expansion it's ever had and that unemployment is near record lows? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer gets us going with the what gives.
There's not just one thing pushing the wealth gap wider and wider. It's a mix of taxes, the stock market, even demographics. Let's start with taxes. The 2017 tax overhaul had big cuts for top earners and business owners. It lowered corporate taxes, too. University of Florida economist Hector Sandoval says companies passed on the money they saved to shareholders.
This is just benefiting a lot of people already wealthy.
The middle class got a tax break, too, but not as big. Wages are rising, but not as much as they normally do during an economic expansion. And Sandoval says about 80% of U.S. households get most of their income from a paycheck. Only about half of American households own stock. And Arlok Sherman at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says the return on investments can be higher than wage growth. So
you can make more money if you're an investor than if you're an ordinary working person.
And here's the demographic part. Those investments, like stocks, but also houses, are concentrated among baby boomers. Donna Ginther, an economist at the University of Kansas, says the boomers' kids, the millennials, aren't so lucky.
Our millennials have debt. They haven't reached peak earnings potential. So that would, again, generate more inequality.
Ginther says that should start to change over the next decade and might help shrink the wealth gap a bit, but we'll need more fundamental change to close it. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Maybe even more than economists and sociologists, it's a pretty safe bet that this morning a whole lot of analysts for retailers and consumer product companies were poring over that ACS data as well. It's kind of a mini census. The ACS is based on a sample of a couple of million households and reveals all kinds of information that is oh so useful to retailers and manufacturers. As Marketplace's Erica Barris reports, it is one of the most valuable services the federal government provides to business and industry.
There's a lot of information in the ACS. People's incomes, races, ages, the type of work they do, even how they get to and from work, and how long that takes. All broken down, community by community. George Washington University professor Andrew Reamer says businesses use that data
to determine where to put storefronts and where to put factories and where to put any kind of business establishment.
Say you're a retail chain that specializes in youth fashion. David French of the National Retail Federation says the survey can help you figure out where to open new stores.
You're probably not going to go into a community that for the past 20 years has been getting older. You're probably going to look for neighborhoods that have younger families moving in.
Retailers also use the survey to determine what to put on the shelves of their stores, depending on the area's demographics. And they aren't the only businesses using the survey. Natalia Sinyaska of the National Association of Home Builders says it helps predict housing demand.
We actually use ACS data on the daily basis. It's without exaggeration.
Now, businesses already collect plenty of their own data on customers. Economist Julia Coronado says the ACS helps to put that data into context.
In an era of big data, the value of government data has gone up, not down, because any company has very detailed information or a lot of data on their own customers and products, but they need to benchmark it against something. What does the broader market look like? What does the broader population look like?
And only the government can provide that kind of data, says Coronado.
It's a public good with a great deal of value for a lot of people in the economy.
Best of all, it's free. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Thursday, down pretty much all day. Not too terribly much, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The last week of the month, of which we are in the middle, is a big one for those wanting to know more about how consumers are feeling about this economy. We got our first Insight on Tuesday, the Consumer Confidence Survey put out by the Conference Board. Insight number two comes tomorrow with the latest release of the University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Index. Now, why are we talking about consumer confidence again, and what is it really? I'm glad you asked, because that's the perfect way to get into the latest installment of our new series, Kai Explains, where we take things real slow to find out what's really happening.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
You recently asked what's going on with this economy.
So how do these two concepts work together?
You want to know how people are feeling about things, even something as big and cumbersome as the American economy, you got to ask them.
Well, for instance, we asked them, how are current business conditions? Are they good, bad, or normal? Very straightforward questions.
That's Lynn Franco. She knows what gets asked because she is the Director of Economic Indicators at the Conference Board, the group that puts out the Consumer Confidence Survey. 3,000 of those surveys every month to collect the latest data, which economists like Lynn spend their whole careers keeping track of because
consumers make up about 70% of the U.S. economy, so having a gauge of how they're feeling is very important.
Basically, if you're feeling good about the economy, you'll decide to spend money, and that money keeps the economy growing. But, and you knew there was going to be a but.
It maybe is important to, you know, essentially always have the disclaimer that, you know, consumer sentiment has often had sharp increases and sharp drops, and nothing has really happened.
Jeremy Piger, professor of economics at the University of Oregon with the assist there. He studies recessions as it happens. And yes, the numbers from this month and last have been soft. But Piger says this one indicator isn't in and of itself a great predictor.
You know, it's not that consumer sentiment isn't correlated with the future economy. It's just that it doesn't provide a lot of additional information over kind of the other data flow that we have available to us.
One more thing, and this goes really for most every economic indicator that's out there. Those numbers come out every month. So the point isn't so much to agonize over differences from one month to the next. You want to look at what's happening over time. Lynn Franco, one more time.
You know, as long as we look at the overall trend and sort of put it in a historical context, then I think we provide the reader with a good overall view of what's really happening.
Or listener, audio, right? Anyway, so that's what's happening with consumers and how they are feeling. A quick update now on our Kai Explains from yesterday, IPOs, initial public offerings, how they work and how they get valued. We talked about Peloton, the bike workout company, I guess is the most basic description. Anyway, they started trading today. The company and its bankers priced shares, thus affecting the value of the company, at $29. Traders felt differently. 27-ish was the opening trade. So we got Andrew Caroli from Cornell back on the phone.
I think this is sort of now the normal volatility.
See also the Uber IPO for one example.
It opened this morning at a couple dollars below, and that is not an unusual outcome for the day after. Everything is moving along normal, tickety-boo.
Tickety-boo. I love that. Also, really, what is the point of an IPO anyway?
I think the key from the perspective of the IPO is that the ultimate stakeholders were able to shop the deal successfully to market raised $1.8 billion. And now there are sort of an infusion of new funds and capital into the company to be able to invest in all sorts of interesting projects That's what they wanted. That's what they got.
PLTN is the ticker symbol if you're interested. Let us know what you want to hear explained next. Would you? You can do that at marketplace.org, or you can hit me up on Twitter. I am at Kai Rizdal, KAIRYSSDAL. Healthcare news now via the Kaiser Family Foundation, which finds the cost of health insurance for families covered by employer-sponsored plans, families that get their insurance through work is the plain English way to say that, it's up 5% this year over last to more than $20,000 a year. Now, the caveat here is that that's the all-in cost, right? Families pay on average a bit more than $6,000 of the $20,000, but that's only for premiums. It doesn't count copayments or deductibles. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more on the rising cost of employer-sponsored insurance.
In her job as a school nurse in Coppell, Texas, a suburb of Dallas, Sally Wietoff has the option of enrolling her family in her employer's health insurance plan. But she hasn't done that. She decided it was just too expensive.
Deductible's quite high. A lot comes out of your paycheck.
The Wietoffs think they found a better deal. They're enrolled in what's called a health share program, a kind of insurance co-op. Not everyone has the option to leave employer-based insurance on the table, but data from the Kaiser Family Foundation shows that the Wietoffs are hardly an exception.
There's a long-term trend away from employer-sponsored health benefits.
Matthew Ray helps run the healthcare marketplace program at Kaiser.
So fewer people are enrolled in employer coverage now than they were 15 or 20 years ago.
So what's leading people to look for alternatives? Mark Fendrick at the University of Michigan Center for Value-Based Insurance Design says it's those rising costs that employers are passing on to workers.
If you're seeing a large number of your paycheck go into your premium and then you have to pay another several thousand dollars before your insurance kicks in, a lot of folks are just saying it's just not worth it.
But for most Americans, employer-based insurance is still the best option. And as far as those rising costs, Fendrick says it's the people on the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder that are suffering the most. The Kaiser Family Foundation says over the last 10 years, average family premiums have increased by more than 50%. That's significantly higher than wage growth and inflation. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
You know private equity, right? Big pools of capital that buy up companies, get value out of them, which is often painful for the companies being bought, and then private equity moves on. That is germane today because the private equity-backed company behind Arby's, Buffalo Wild Wings, and Sonic is buying the sandwich chain Jimmy John's, amount not disclosed. Inspire Brands is the new owner. It's also got ties to Auntie Anne's Pretzels and Carl's Jr. And it is not the only firm that's been buying into the food business lately. Marketplace Justin Ho has that one.
Think about Jimmy John's, Arby's, or Sonic. They're fast food spots. You don't have to sit down and order. John Stanton researches food marketing at St. Joseph's University. He says private equity firms see the casual concept as having a lot of potential for growth.
I think they're recognizing that younger generations are choosing to spend money on convenience.
And by buying the Jimmy John's chain, Inspire Brands is likely to start thinking about how to use its franchises to capitalize on that trend.
Can franchising be logically expanded, either here in the United States or outside of the United States?
That's John Gordon, a restaurant chain analyst for the Pacific Management Consulting Group. He says unlike other private equity firms, Jimmy John's new owner has a history of holding on to companies for a while before selling them.
You can pocket the cash flow that the business produces for a long period of time, and then at some later point, you can take it public.
Before Inspire Brands' investment in Jimmy John's to really pay off, Inspire Brands will have to do more than cost-cutting and paying down debt, says Donna Hittrich, who runs the private equity program at Columbia Business School.
Growth requires investment. That investment may be in capital or it may be in people.
She says a lot of private equity firms are specializing in sectors like the restaurant industry, because that lets them get more efficient at growing their companies. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Really, any bus coming off the assembly line these days, you know, it's going to have cybersecurity risk associated with it.
Hacking meets your daily commute. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 79 points today. That's about 0.3%, 26,891. The NASDAQ gave back 46, about 0.5%, 8,030. The S&P 500 returned 7 points, 0.2%, 2,977 there. Peloton, we talked about, it slid down 11% for the day. ExxonMobil is selling its Norway exploration assets for $4.5 billion. Sales part of a plan to divest nearly $15 billion in assets by 2021. ExxonMobil lost about 0.5% today. Beyond Meat sizzled up 11.5% after McDonald's said it's going to test Beyond's plant-based burgers in Canada. Sandwich is going to be called PLT. Get it? P? Plant? Lettuce? Tomato? You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Finding good, safe, affordable housing is a growing problem in this economy, even for people who find themselves in the best of circumstances. For people who've been convicted of a crime and are getting out of prison, difficult doesn't even begin to describe it. Communities don't necessarily want them. Landlords can be reluctant to rent. So a government housing agency in the Chicago suburbs is experimenting with a program to help drug court graduates get a fresh start. From WBEZ in Chicago, Natalie Moore reports.
This is the living room here. As you see, the kitchen.
Johnny Washington shows off his apartment in Forest Park, a suburb of Chicago. He can't remember the last time he had his own place. He's in recovery after nearly 50 years of heroin addiction. He's been in and out of prison over the last 15 years.
Using drugs, you really don't care about anything or whatever, or nothing that happens in your life.
Washington, who's 66 now, has been working in shipping at a candy factory since the beginning of the year. But he says the real stabilizing force in his life has been this apartment, where he's lived since July. He says it's the best he's felt in a long time. It took him a while to get here. 2 years ago, Washington landed in the Cook County Drug Court Program. It's a special court created for nonviolent offenders struggling with substance abuse. The focus is on treatment, not criminalization. The court put him in a residential treatment program for people exiting the criminal justice system, but he could only live there temporarily and time was running out.
I looked for housing for like 2-3 months and I couldn't find anything because everywhere I went, they wanted, you know, high credit scores, and my credit scores weren't that high.
Then Washington got a call from Cook County Judge Charles Burns this summer with good news. Washington had qualified for a housing voucher in a new program with the Cook County Housing Authority. He pays 30% of his income toward rent. The county picks up the rest. Judge Burns oversees the court, and he says 49% of people who enter the program have no housing. The judge says homelessness, and in Washington's case, bad credit, are roadblocks to recovery. The housing program offers
an opportunity not only for them to get vouchers, to get clean in a stable housing, but to get them out of the neighborhoods that have been sucking them in and being like quicksand where they couldn't get out of this lifestyle.
The Illinois Justice Project and Metropolitan Planning Council recently released a report about housing problems for people coming out of jail. King Harris is one of the authors.
When we did this, we asked ourselves, to what degree would better housing allow people to have better lives and be more successful?
And stay out of jail. Judge Burns also wanted to know the answer. So last year, he invited Cook County Housing Authority Executive Director Richard Minocchio to a drug court graduation and explain the housing barriers.
I was a convert on day one because, you know, we have a very scarce resource here in housing assistance. here you have people that really need it, and if they get it, are very likely to succeed. So marrying those two concepts seemed to me to make a lot of sense.
The Housing Authority issues 15,000 Section 8 housing vouchers to low-income county residents every year. 25 of them are going to drug court graduates. If the pilot program is successful, it could be expanded. Johnny Washington is the first recipient, and he says it's helping to keep him sober.
Since I've been clean, I've been really reconnecting with my kids, my family.
He says without the voucher, he'd be on the street. In Chicago, I'm Natalie Moore for Marketplace.
These are not the best of times to be a Chinese company in the American economy. Huawei, the big telecommunications conglomerate, is probably the best example. Excluded by the Trump administration over fears of hacking and unfair competition. Congress says it wants to ban Chinese rail cars from American subways. And now, how about Chinese buses? There is a bill moving on Capitol Hill to do just that. So, actual national security threat or maybe a convenient opportunity for American bus makers to squeeze out a Chinese competitor? Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one.
This is the sound of a Chinese factory lured to America. The Chinese bus maker BYD makes buses in Lancaster, California, an hour north of L.A. In 5 years, it has sold more than 500 public buses in the States, $750,000 each. They're zero emission and battery powered, says company director Zach Kahn.
BYD started as a battery manufacturer, so we are battery experts first and foremost.
To follow what are called Buy America rules, BYD has its plant here. It uses 60% American parts, 700 American Union workers. Even its lunch whistle is made in America. But now Congress may ban BYD from the U.S. public bus market through a provision in a defense spending bill.
Buses were dragged into this conversation by accident.
Jeff Davis is with the Eno Center for Transportation. It's a research group. He says when the Senate passed measures to ban Chinese subway rail cars,
they implicitly also applied to buses as well. Locking BYD out of that would be a significant problem for them.
And a boon for BYD's American rivals. U.S. bus makers Proterra and New Flyer support this measure, but declined our interview requests.
Once the American bus manufacturers realize that there's this free opportunity to possibly block BYD out of future market growth, then, yeah, I'm certain that their lobbyists got in on this.
Here's the concern about Chinese buses. When you board an electric bus, like this one in D.C., if it's made by a Chinese company, it's hackable, so says Scott Paul at the Alliance for American Manufacturing.
People are familiar with Huawei and its potential security threat to telecommunications and to 5G. The same can be said about BYD.
He suggests BYD, quote, has to answer to Beijing, and that the automaker or Chinese intelligence could hack into security cameras and surveil passengers, say, scan their faces between stops.
New Hampshire Avenue and M Street.
Would facial recognition software be used to identify Chinese nationals of interest in the United States, particularly dissidents? These are concerns that are not easily addressed.
To which BYD's Zach Kahn replies,
BYD has no ability to pull data off our bus remotely. Once our buses are delivered to our customers, all the data that's on those buses are our customers' data. We have no access to it.
And he says the company's not very Chinese. It's not state-owned, it's publicly traded, and Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway is a big investor.
No one has pointed to any evidence of any wrongdoing by BYD. Obviously, there's bigger issues going on between China and the U.S., but BYD has come to this country and followed all the rules of the road.
We ran the cyber bus question by Stanford's Andy Grotto. He runs cybersecurity for the Obama and the Trump White Houses. He says public transport has been hacked before. In Poland, a 14-year-old techie once took remote control of a public tram.
If you've ever been on a train or a bus where it stops and starts and how jarring that could be when the legitimate drivers of control. Imagine how dangerous that could be if a malicious actor were to get a hold of it.
But he says any bus from any company, not just a Chinese one, is vulnerable.
Really, any bus coming off the assembly line these days, you know, it's going to have cybersecurity risk associated with it. That risk exists regardless of where in the world the bus was manufactured.
That may be true, but this is a China moment. Official Washington has stated bipartisan suspicion of Chinese policies, companies, technologies, and scientists. This Chinese bus ban has support from the Senate, the White House, and BYD's competitors. It's attached to a spending bill that passes every year. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, which I'm obliged to preface by saying that I love babies. I got four kids. They're older now, but they were babies once. Traveled with them on planes when they were little, so I've been there. But not everybody can relate. And for those who can't, Japan Airlines has just the thing. New seat maps that'll tell you where the babies on the flight will be sitting, which is kind of genius. But also, and seriously, parents of screaming babies on planes, give them a break. They are having a worse time than you are, I promise. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's down 79 points today, 0.3%. NASDAQ gave back 46 points, about a 0.5%. The S&P 500, 7 points on the downside, 0.2%. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, and Haran Bekela are the Marketplace editing staff. Betsy Streisand is the brand new managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.